Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Exodus 23. I think we can just launch right into chapter 23 tonight. I've spent weeks creating context for this, so I think we can start in Exodus 23. And Exodus 23 is going to start right out with, don't bear false witness, which should sound very familiar. It's one of the Ten Commandments. Now let's go back and review for a moment this concept that is very, very popular in the church, that the Ten Commandments constitute what's called the moral law, and that the moral law is bigger than, supersedes the whole rest of the law, that the law can be broken down into categories, and that the moral law starts all the way back at Eden, or at very least right after the fall, and continues through the law and into the new covenant because it is, after all, the moral law. And the Ten Commandments, therefore, constituting the moral law, continue throughout all time and are always binding on the conscience of all people. And so now we're going to bump right into one of the Ten Commandments, right at the top of this chapter. And in fact, in a couple of verses, he's also going to get into the Sabbath. Keep the Sabbath day, keep the Sabbath year. Okay, that would fall under the broad category of moral law then. He's also going to get into not killing. Don't kill. Don't kill an innocent person. Okay, one of the Ten Commandments. That's all going to be right here in the early part of chapter 23, except that mixed in between them, there is also a law that says, if you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey wandering away, you will surely return it to him. Intermixed with the big moral law pieces. So where does that rule fall? When we start chapter 23, are we reading what constitutes the moral law? Or are we just reading another section of the law? The law can contain any rules God wants to add in here. So I have contended over and over and over again that you can't break the law down into these artificial categories. You can't say the law is partly moral and partly civil and partly ceremonial and partly religious and then say now these parts are done away with and these parts are still intact. And despite the popularity of the concept of the moral law superseding the rest of the law and being binding on the conscience of all people in all time, if you just read the details of the law, it's very hard to conclude that because of exactly what we're about to see. Where the moral law, quote unquote, comes launching out right at the top of the chapter, and then we make a leap to what seems like a really odd, insignificant rule. So, is the rule don't kill any more significant in the law than the rule return your enemy's animals? Well, not the way it's written. As you read the context of these rules, it's just a rule and a rule and a rule and a rule, and there's no indication that some of these rules are the important ones, the significant ones, the moral ones. And these other rules are kind of catch-as-catch-can, do it or don't, whatever you think. Instead, it all constitutes the law. And since in the New Testament, we are frequently told that if you start trying to justify yourself by the law, you are a debtor to do the whole law, then whole law includes things like make sure and return your enemy's animals, because it's part of the law. So let's start reading. You shall not bear a false report. Do not join your hand with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. So in other words, don't bear false witness. Which of the Ten Commandments is that?
Seven.
Six.
That's one of them, right?
Megan, cats lie. It's nine. It's the ninth commandment. Years ago, on a Wednesday night, I taught a little mnemonic device where you could remember the Ten Commandments. And it was fun and easy, and a half hour later, everybody knew all the Ten Commandments, forward, backward. You could call a number, they could tell you the commandment, you could tell a commandment, they'd tell you the number. Chapter 23, verse 1 clearly is a recitation of don't bear false witness. True? Okay, so have we at this moment wandered into the moral law? Because a moment ago, he said that you'll be holy men, just like me. That's the end of the previous chapter. Therefore, you shall not eat any flesh torn into pieces in the field. You shall throw that to the dogs. So that's kind of a generic don't eat torn up meat. It's not good for you. And of course, there's no chapter divisions in the original writing, and there's no verse divisions. The very next rule is a recitation of one of the Ten Commandments. So clearly, now we've launched into the moral law if those subdivisions actually exist, which they don't. And the next verse says, you shall not follow a multitude in doing evil. In other words, don't join a gang. Nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after a multitude in order to pervert justice. So all of this has to do with being a witness, being a false witness, trying to get along with the group by bearing testimony to things you don't know, being willing to lie in order to pervert justice. This is all tied in with that ninth commandment. Nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his dispute. If a poor man goes to the law, goes to court, comes to the judges, then you make sure not to prefer the rich one over the poor one. These are all real good rules, but we've kind of slipped from moral to kind of civil, judicial at this point. And verse 4 suddenly, almost as if out of nowhere, says, if you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey wandering away, you will surely return it to him. Isn't that a strange juxtaposition? And of course, Moses gives you no warning. God gives you no warning. He just goes from what seems like a Ten Commandment moral law to just a very social, civil, return your enemy's animals kind of rule. So I'm at the risk of beating a dead horse. I'm making the point over and over again that if you view the details, this idea of being able to divide the law up into subcategories, it's very, very difficult to do. Actually, I would argue it's impossible to do. Yes, sir?
Just wanted to point out that under the English common law, you have no duties that are affirmative. You never have to actually pull the baby out of the puddle or return a donkey. Common law has only negative things, not positive things.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Whereas there are positives in this law.
Yeah. This is pretty good.
That's a very positive. Yeah. Even your enemy, by the way. Not just your neighbor or a friend. If you see an animal wandering, and you know who it belongs to, and it belongs to an enemy, you still have to take it back. Which, by the way, might help to repair that relationship a bit, I suppose. Yes, sir?
As long as we're here.
Yeah.
The verse that says about, do not show favoritism to a poor man in his lawsuit, that doesn't read as if you're showing favoritism to the rich man over the poor man, but it appears to say don't show...
Yeah, favoritism is an odd translation. I mean, again, you're talking about a Jewish word that has to do with partiality.
The other translation, nor shall you be partial to a poor man.
Right, yeah. The idea being that you're not going to judge based on a person's social status, whether rich or poor, you're going to judge a fair judgment. And that partiality would be you look at a poor man and say, well, I'm going to judge either for him because he's poor, or I'm going to judge against him because he's poor.
It kind of restricts your desire to show mercy to the poor man, though, doesn't it?
Right. I would think that's true. Yep. Because there's a lot to be said later in the law as we continue through it about making sure that your weights and your scales are even, that judgment is always equal. That's sort of a hallmark of the law. Verse 5 then says, if you see the donkey of one who hates you laying helpless under its load, you shall refrain from leaving it to him. You shall surely release it with him. Now think about that rule for a moment. That means you're going down the street. You see the donkey of a man who hates you. He's an enemy. But he has overloaded the donkey. And the donkey is now down on the ground under the load. You're not allowed to walk away. You have to stop and help the donkey with that load. Anybody followed that law recently? Anybody caught up with that one? Okay, now remember the rule. If you seek to be justified before God by the law, you're a debtor to do the whole law. So you're indebted to that law. You're indebted to that rule. Anybody seen a struggling animal, helpless animal, and walked away, driven away, not helped? Some of the nicer people in the room are going, no, I've always helped. I've seen animals before and said, oh, that poor thing, and driven away. Oh, I know, I'm harsh, I'm cruel, I'm mean. Yes, Elizabeth.
But you know, you worry about, would that apply to a car, a broken down car? I mean, I have been guilty of helping people when I shouldn't because it's not to my safety, you know? Mm-hmm. And that would be a hard rule because your heart's in the right place, but maybe their intent is not.
Which is why it's interesting here that it says, if you see the donkey of a man who hates you,
you
still have to help the donkey.
Yeah.
Sure.
I know it's hard, and I know I would not stop and help someone on the side of the highway because of the safety issue. But does that say something negative about my faith that, you know, perhaps I should stop and have faith in the fact that God will take care of me?
The best thing is we're not under this law.
Jennifer said the best thing is you're not under the law. I would say this, and this isn't necessarily a phrase you find in the Bible, but it's a reality. There's a difference between faith and foolishness. And I put that under Jesus saying, you don't tempt the Lord your God. Even the devil said, throw yourself off this spire because it's written that his angels will bear you up so you don't dash your foot against a rock. And he said, you don't tempt the Lord your God. I mean, you, little slip of a woman, driving at night by yourself, if you see somebody pulled over by the side of the road, call for help, but don't get out of the car. I would tell my daughter the same thing. Then verse 6, and I think this answers your question, Tom, and you shall not pervert the justice due to your needy brother in his dispute. So he's saying no matter what, a needy brother gets his justice, and that you can't prefer him or judge against him just because he's poor. But did you notice that verse 6 is actually a continuation of the rule that ended in verse 3, which is actually a continuation of the recitation of the ninth commandment in verse 1, and yet right in the middle of those rules about not bearing false witness, not perverting justice, not preferring anybody because of their social status, right in the middle of that are the animal rules. So they work as a unit. And if you're going to say, the 10 are binding on the moral conscience of everyone forever, so are the animal rules because they're inclusive in this set of rules. Keep far away from a false charge. And do not kill the innocent or the righteous, for I will not acquit the guilty. There's thou shalt not kill. Okay, which one is that?
Six.
That's
six.
Number.
It's number six.
Wait.
Exactly.
It's number 6.
Oh, good. Thanks. If you're good to me, I'll teach you the memory device, and then you'll all know. So keep far from a false charge. Do not kill the innocent or the righteous, for I will not acquit the guilty. Certainly feels like we're right back into the moral law, doesn't it? And yet somewhere in the midst of that, there's the animal rules, like helping a donkey of your enemy with his load. And you shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the clear-sighted and subverts the cause of the just. Now we seem to be back to the justice and not bearing false witness idea. So all these ideas are intermingling. And you shall not oppress a stranger, since you yourselves know the feelings of a stranger, for you also were strangers in the land of Egypt. Does that not once again identify who the recipients of this law are?
Israel.
This is Israel's covenant. I keep saying it and saying it, but who here in this room then has ever been a slave in Egypt? Anybody? Stranger in Egypt? Anyone? You're tempted, I know. No, you haven't. Well, then if that's not your history and you're not a part of that people group, are you part of this covenant? You can't be. This covenant, these rules, this law were made with a specific people. And you shall, verse 10, and you shall sow your land for 6 years and gather in its yield. But on the seventh year, you shall let it rest and lay fallow. Now we're into Sabbath rules. Anybody here got a garden? My neighbor across the street does.
I used to.
Every seventh year, then, you got to just let it lay fallow. Have you done that? Every seventh year, just let it grow wild?
Well, every 7 years.
You didn't know to. You know what? That doesn't work. It's not an excuse. Where the law is concerned, lack of knowledge is not an excuse. But that's true of any law. Right? You were a lawyer, right? Ignorance of the law is no excuse. You can say that in Latin. Not that it comes up frequently, but let's hear it.
Ignorantia legis neminem excusat.
That means ignorance of the law is no excuse. It's an axiom in legal circles. You can't go to a judge and say, yes, I was doing 55 through a school zone, but I didn't know. You still did it. You still broke the law. You're still guilty. It's still your responsibility. Same thing here. Everyone in Israel was given this law, and in the next chapter, they're going to agree to it. They're going to agree and say, okay, Moses, everything God said we're going to do. Now later do they get to go, oh, I didn't know about the donkey rule. It's their responsibility to know. So ignorance is no excuse.
So really, we're okay considering...
No.
We don't need to worry about picking up hitchhikers.
Right.
Or going past animals. Because this is all under Israel, so...
You're asking a really good question. You're not asking it well, but you're asking a really good question. It was a really good question, though. You're on track here. What Charlie's getting at, if I may interpret for her, is very much like what you said. Well, then, is it a test of my faith whether I stop and help somebody? Because you just naturally gravitated toward, well, it says it in the law, so then I should be responsible for it in some way. She was putting it in the negative. Well, then is it a test of my faith? She was putting it in the positive. Well, then it's okay if I don't do those things. They were both referring back to these rules. And she was saying, so then it's okay if I don't follow every one of those rules? She was saying, am I guilty if I don't follow all of those rules? Both of them were saying, what is my responsibility before these rules? Because we're reading these rules, and we are naturally, get this in your head, we are naturally legalistic in our flesh. We are performance-based. As humans, we think our performance counts for something before God. Even when we say, it's grace, it's grace, it's grace, it's grace, when we go through a period where we mess up a lot, it's natural for us to think, well, God must be really unhappy with me right now, and he probably loves me less, and my relationship with him is probably real sketchy right now because I haven't been very good. Well, then you're thinking along those legalistic lines that say God cares about you on the basis of what you do. The reality is his love is constant and consistent because it's not based on your performance. It's based on his character, his nature, his determination to love you. And your salvation is not based on your behavior. It's based on Christ's finished atoning work. So everything necessary to establish your relationship with God is already in place. All the performance stuff is a reaction to that. So your Christian faith is not dependent on these rules. But when we read the rules, we all naturally think, well, that rule must apply to me in some way. And that's because there is a morality and there is an ethic attached to Christianity. But it is a reaction to our salvation. It is not the cause of our salvation. But we want to be good, and that's fine. We do want to be good. But your question was along the lines of, is it a test of my faith if I stop? Yeah. No, it's not a test of your faith. If you can do something good, do it. But be smart. God would much rather, I'm quite certain, as a loving father, would much rather that you not be attacked. Right? So be wise. You had your hand up, Marilyn?
Well, conceding that this has nothing to do with our salvation, but since these laws are a reflection of the mind of God,
right,
then we're drawn to them because we get a glimpse of him in those rules, and therefore we're drawn to want to listen to what he has to say.
And that's why we're reading it. That's why we're reading the whole of the law, as a matter of education, so that we understand Israel's history and the exclusivity of Israel's covenant, and also, yes, to understand the mind of God. Like you said, well, I'd like to be good. Okay, here are some standards that God lays out that will help you understand what God expects in terms of good behavior. But even some of the good behavior is so exclusive and specific to Israel when it talks about doing this to a brother and this to a stranger. That's talking about to an Israelite versus a non-Israelite, to the Goyim. Well, those rules are tough for us to do because we're not a part of Israel. So we have to be wise even in how we read and understand and assimilate the law to ourselves.
If yes. we do these things, who will benefit, if anyone?
I think the person that we help, you know, would benefit.
You will benefit.
Yeah. We will too. Right?
Yeah, and I think we will too.
But it depends on your motives.
Very good. Marilyn just said it depends on your motive, and that's exactly right. That's what Paul writes about a lot. It's not that Paul ever said, don't perform the things in the law, especially when he was among Israel. In the book of Acts, when he was in Israel, he did legal, shaved his head and killed an animal and went into the temple, because it wasn't that the law was bad. The law was right and holy. But he was very clear to say, but don't use it as a means to try to justify yourself before God. And that's the division that seems to be missing, or at least is so muddy in so much of modern Christian religion, is that they don't know how to deal with the law versus grace or the new covenant. They don't draw those distinctives, so people do walk around asking the very kind of questions that Stacy and Charlie have asked, because they don't know, is the law binding on me? Do I have to do it? Am I being judged by it? Am I being justified by it? Is it a matter of my own sanctification? What's the purpose and point and function of the law? So that's why I'm trying to be just as explicit and as clear as I can possibly be about it. But as I keep saying, your relationship with God is not ultimately dependent on those rules, because your justification was accomplished when Christ was brought up out of the grave. So you've got to keep those things in their proper order. Your relationship with God is established because of God's absolute sovereign grace. Will you react then in a positive way if you are a Christian? Yes, absolutely. If you fail in any one of those, is your relationship with God destroyed? No. That's what I'm getting at. Okay? Does that help?
Yes.
Okay, good. Where in the world were we? Oh, we're into the Sabbath. Chapter 23, verse 10. And you shall sow your land for 6 years and gather in its yield, but on the seventh year you shall let it rest and lay fallow, so that the needy of your people may eat, and whatever they leave, the beast of the field may eat. You are to do the same with your vineyard and your olive grove. So if for 6 years you've cultivated land and planted it, on the seventh year it's going to grow again. It's going to grow wild. You're not going to be out there tending to it, but it's going to grow again, and it's going to bear fruit again, and you're not allowed to go out and collect it. You have to leave it so that the needy and the beasts and everybody else can have it. And that rule, letting the land keep its Sabbaths every 7 years, and then you had to do it for 2 years every 49 years, because the 50th year was a year of Jubilee, that rule was in place so that every 7 years they had to stop and depend on God. God's going to supply. God's going to take care of us. God would supply during those 6 years. Enough to get you through your seventh year. You had to keep depending on him. And Israel's failure to keep that rule resulted in the Babylonian captivity. And he said, you know what? Since you didn't keep my Sabbaths, since you didn't let the land keep its Sabbaths, I'm going to give the land back the Sabbaths you took from it. And for 70 years, you're going to be out of the land. And the land's going to lay. It's going to keep its Sabbaths. Which is why Daniel, toward the end of it, having read Jeremiah and understanding that it was going to be a 70-year thing, prays to God, well, then keep your word and make it only 70 years. And then the angel Gabriel comes and talks to him and says, God's going to keep it 70 years, but let me tell you what the next 490 years are going to be like for your people, which is 70 times 7. So God keeps dealing in these Sabbath numbers, these seven numbers, and these cycles of sevens. So they're very important to God. Now, if you've done what God has told you to do, if during the 6 years you've stored up and laid aside, if you've given your tithes and your first fruits, if you've done everything you're supposed to do, you'll get through that seventh year. But that takes a tremendous amount of faith and a tremendous amount of confidence that God's going to keep His word. So every 7 years, it was like the big test for Israel. Do you still trust me? I took you into the land of milk and honey. I've provided for you. Do you still trust me? And so they just quit doing it because they didn't trust Him. So God made sure to take His Sabbaths back. Yes?
Was everybody's seventh year the same year, or did it just, you know, vary?
Yes. It was on the religious calendar.
So the Jubilee and everything was all timed up together?
Exactly right. Otherwise, you'd have like one family having Jubilee this year and another family having Jubilee next year. And yeah, these were Israel's feasts. And in fact, this is right where he's going. The next thing he's going to get to after laying out the Sabbaths is 3 times a year, all Israel has to come to my feasts. So yes, there was a very specific calendar that all of Israel nationally had to react to. By the way, anybody lately kept a Jubilee year? Sabbath year. Have you been keeping the Sabbath years? The folks who keep the Sabbath, who say they're keeping the Sabbath, who meet for their worship on Saturday and then like to point out that they are somehow more justified before God because they're keeping the Sabbath by meeting on Saturday, I invariably ask them if they're keeping the 7-year Sabbath then. You know, you're stopping all your work every 7 years, doing no planting, not working a job, just trusting God to take care of you that year. You doing that? None of them are. But see, if you start down that road of Sabbaths, you got to keep them all because they're not divided up. You'll notice that he goes right from the 7-year Sabbath to verse 12. 6 days you are to do your work, but on the seventh day you shall cease from your labor in order that your ox and your donkey may rest and the son of your female slave as well as your stranger may refresh themselves. Notice the positive tone of the Sabbath rule. It's so that everybody could take a break and rest, which is why Jesus would later say to the Pharisees when they questioned his healing on the Sabbath and his eating corn on the Sabbath, and he said to them, the Sabbath was made for man. Man was not made for the Sabbath. He understood that the point of the Sabbath rule was for the rest, so that you couldn't overwork your animal or overwork your slave or overwork. God was taking care to make sure that everyone got sufficient rest and were treated fairly. So notice, for the folks who try to say that they're Sabbatarians, that they keep the Sabbath, that they meet on Saturdays, you'll notice that verse 12 would be your justification to do that. But verse 10 and 11 are right ahead of it and are all part of the same command. So if you're going to keep Saturday, you got to keep the seventh year, and you got to keep the 50th year. You got to keep all the rules. You don't get to pick and choose. Now, concerning everything which I have said to you, verse 13, be on your guard, and do not mention the name of other gods, nor let them be heard from your mouth. That kind of harkens back to rules 1, 2, and 3, doesn't it? No other gods before me, don't make any graven images, don't take the name of the Lord in vain. It seems to tie into that, and then verse 14 gets right into the national feasts. 3 times a year you will celebrate a feast to me. By the way, feast is an interesting English interpretation of it because, especially 1611, King James and stuff, they understood feasts, festivals, those kind of things. What the word, the Hebrew word is that's translated feast here, the most literal rendering of it would be set time. These are the set times of the Lord. Translated feast, because he's going to say 3 times a year at this particular time, you have to do these things. So the Sabbath and the Sabbath year and the 50th year and 3 times a year, God is setting calendar dates and saying you do these things on these dates because he's a very specific God who is very meticulous in the details. And the reason these feasts are important is that these fall feasts in particular are going to have to fall on one particular year exactly in such an order that Jesus can die on one and be buried on the next and be raised on the next and the church can be established on the next. And so it's very important that Israel continue to keep these feasts exactly as God lays them out, because the details count in leading to the Messiah. So for roughly 1,400 years, they're going to keep these feasts, not really knowing why. Okay, three times a year, we got to go to Jerusalem. Okay. So he says, three times a year you shall celebrate a feast to me. You shall observe the feast of unleavened bread. For 7 days you are to eat unleavened bread as I commanded you at the appointed time in the month of Abib, for in it you came out of Egypt, and none shall appear before me empty-handed. Now, are we responsible to keep that feast, considering that the feast is going to include go to Jerusalem? Every family that can travel has to be in Jerusalem three times a year. Are we responsible for that? By the way, do you know what you're supposed to bring to Jerusalem with you? A lot of people don't know this. Do you know what you bring to Jerusalem with you the three times a year that you go? Those are all right, but you know where you get the food? Your tithes. You take your tithes.
Because you're going to have a big party.
Because you're going to have a big party. You know what you do with your tithes when you get to Jerusalem?
Eat
them. You eat your tithes. A lot of the tithing teachers out there won't tell you that. The church up the street, who shall remain big and nameless, they, for the last couple of years, are not only promoting systematic 10% tithing, which, by the way, is only a percentage of what Israel's whole tithes were. If you put all the tithes together, they actually equaled more like 30% of your gross income. But not only are they doing systematic 10% tithing, but they now have it where they can deduct it straight out of your checking account. Direct deposit. So you don't have to think about it. They said it's giving without the effort. That's the marketing phrase they're using to help people do their tithing. Giving without the effort.
How's that hilarious?
How's that for hilarious? Exactly. There's hilarious giving at its best. Now, I'm betting, and I'll take anybody's bet on this. I don't care how much you want to bet on this, because it's going to be my money when it's over. I'll bet that the folks up the street have never heard that you're supposed to eat your tithes. Your tithes are set aside so that you can take them to Jerusalem, so that when you get there, you have something for the feast before the Lord. That's part of the purpose of tithing. Yes, there was also the every third year tithe that you would put in the storehouse so that the hungry and the poor had some. Then the tithe was used specifically for the Levites. You know, the Levites would have to get their portions. And then you had to make sure when you showed up for these feasts, you had sufficient food and drink. And in fact, it says if the distance is too long for you to bring the tithe of your animals and your grains and stuff with you, that it would be too much for you to carry because you had a prosperous time and 10% is more than you can take to Jerusalem. You're supposed to sell it where you live, take the money in your hand, go to Jerusalem, and use the money to buy whatever your soul desires. And it includes, by the way, food, wine, and strong drink.
Yes.
Yeah, yes. Oh, he's testifying. Yes. Yeah, but it's there. It's in the text. That's what the tithes are for. The tithe is so that three times a year you have a good party. You have a good feast before the Lord, and you do that with your 10th percents. I'm guessing that's never been taught up the road.
What if they use their 10% to buy the bread and wine and stuff and pay for the electric bills and the water bills?
That is another issue that comes up later, because instead of using the tithes the way God said to, just like not doing the Sabbath, Israel starts not doing their tithes the way they're supposed to. And that's what the end of the book of Malachi, the last book of the Old Testament, is all about. The reason that the Old Testament ends with the word curse is all about tithes, where God says, you have robbed me. And you'll say, wherein have we robbed you? And I will say, in your tithes and offerings. And so then he says, bring all the tithes into the storehouse and see if I don't pour out a blessing more than you can contain. But because they didn't do that, the Old Testament ends with, you're cursed with a curse.
So tithes have nothing to do with giving to the church. They were giving
to the church. Tithe has nothing to do with giving to the church. You're exactly right.
Okay.
Because the church is not the storehouse.
Or the Levitical priesthood.
And there is no more Levitical priesthood. And there is no more, very important, law. We're not under the law that demands all that, right? We're under the new covenant. We don't need Levitical priests. We have a high priest sitting at the right hand of God, an intercessor, a mediator who's there all the time mediating for us. We don't need the Levites. And we don't have storehouses. Now, does that mean you shouldn't give? Well, the New Testament's full of verses about giving. Sure, you should give to the church. Sure, you should support the ministry of the gospel. Absolutely. But do you have to give systematic tithes for fear that God will curse you? No, of course not, because we're not under that law. See why it's so important to get the law grace thing right? Because then, when you're sitting in a pew somewhere and some guy starts thundering down on you about, you've robbed God because you've kept his tithes in your wallet. Now here comes the plate. Give your tithes. You have the freedom to go, nope, don't think so. Won't be doing that because I stand fast in the liberty wherewith Christ has set me free and I will not be entangled with the yoke of bondage. You have the freedom to say that. You shall observe the Feast of Unleavened Bread. For 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread as I commanded you at the appointed time in the month of Abib. For in it you came out of Egypt, and none shall appear before me empty-handed. Right, bring your tithes. Also you shall observe the Feast of the Harvest, of the first fruits of your labors, from what you sow in the field, and also the Feast of Ingathering at the end of the year, when you will gather the fruit of your labors from the field. 3 times a year all your males shall appear before the Lord God. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread, nor is the fat of my feast to remain overnight until morning. You shall bring the choice first fruits of your soil into the house of the Lord your God. You are not to boil a kid in the milk of its mother. Doesn't that seem like an odd juxtaposition? Because think now, we're doing the feasts. This is big stuff. You must appear before me, the feasts of God. This is high religious stuff. And right in the middle of that, and oh yeah, don't boil a kid in its mother's milk. Now I kind of understood the blood one. You know, don't add blood with the unleavened bread. Okay, I get that rule. That makes sense. Okay. But if you're going to boil a kid, don't boil it in its mother's milk. I'll ask Conrad's question. Who does that benefit?
Poor goat.
It seems like an odd rule, but the question is this. Was an Israelite guilty of breaking the law of God if they broke that rule?
Yes.
Yes. Just as much as the killing rule, just as much as the Sabbath rule, just as much as the false witness rule, there's also this rule.
And it took the same atonement. It took the same sacrifice. They said, oh, you killed someone. Yeah, that does not good.
Yeah, you're still going to have to kill an animal. You're still going to have to come up with a sin offering. There's still going to have to be some kind of payment. You broke the law.
But there wasn't like, they just like, oh, you know, that sin, you can
right.
Use a dove. You don't right. Have to do a dove. You don't have to bring a cow.
Right. That was like a minor break.
Yeah.
So you bring something small. Sacrifice
I
a little.
I the milk. I think I boiled the kid and his mom's.
You still had to bring a sin offering. You broke the law. Yes?
Why do they even call it the Ten Commandments when you have a good 500? Why don't they call it the 500 Commandments?
Because what Moses actually brings down.
Oh, okay.
Now on the tablets.
Okay.
And that's why you have to understand what the tablets are. They're called the tablets of the covenant.
Right, okay.
And so they are like the big overview rules, and these are all the details that go with those 10.
Okay, I see.
But those tablets, this is very important, Charlie, those tablets are a physical embodiment in stone of the fact that God made a covenant with Israel, which is why they're called the stone tablets of the covenant, and they're put inside the box called the Ark of the Covenant. It keeps speaking of the same thing, which is that this law, in its entirety, establishes a covenant with Israel. This is not God saying, here are rules that all people everywhere are responsible for. By the way, when God laid out these rules at Sinai, were they binding on the Chinese?
No.
Australians? Pygmies in Borneo? They were only really binding on Israel.
They are binding. They just weren't given to them, so they had no chance of appeasing God. I mean,
well, Paul talks about that in the book of Romans and says, talks about the Gentiles who had no law, who became a law unto themselves, their conscience either accusing or excusing them. So Paul talks about those that don't have the law, which means that there are some people groups on the planet that didn't have the law. So my point again is, when God laid out these rules at Sinai, he laid them out with a specific people group, his chosen people group. And only they knew the rules, only they had the rules, so only they were under the covenant established by those rules. So then, for those folks who say, these are the moral laws of God binding on the conscience of all men at all places and all times, you can't get that from the details. The same God who can pick and choose and elect in the new covenant has always been that way.
Absolutely. And he chose Israel to say, hey, y'all got a chance.
Exactly. He chose Israel and said, you're going to be my covenant people. And he formed a covenant with those people. The same way that he formed the new covenant with the people he chose. So he has always been a picking, choosing God.
The law conditional, though? The covenant, rather, of the law?
Is it conditional?
If you do this,
absolutely.
Then you get this?
Yes. Absolutely. And if you don't do it, I will punish you.
Yeah, that's right. One of my question. Well, what's the difference then in an Israelite and a Philistine and a Chinese? If no one could have done it, what's the point of saying I pick you? If well, you can't do it anyway. I'm telling you all this stuff that you can't do. What's the difference in that and the Chinese? And
that's
Israel?
What Paul addresses specifically in Romans 1, 2, and 3. Because among the Israelites, they felt like because they had been chosen, that they were descendants of Abraham, that they did have the law. He even addresses it and says, well, you know, what advantage does the Jew have then? He says, well, much in every way. I mean, to Israel belongs the law and the prophets. But the first three chapters, he starts with Gentiles are guilty, Jews are guilty, the whole world's guilty. And that's when he gets into everyone is guilty because the creation itself reveals everything that can be known of God. Therefore, they're responsible for their denial of him and their suppression of the truth because it's been revealed in the creation. So then Paul's conclusion is God did it that way so that every mouth will be stopped and every man stands guilty before him. So the Israelites who thought that because they were the descendants of Abraham, because they were Israelites who had the covenants and had the promises and had all that, they thought, well, we'll be okay before God. So it was shocking when Paul came along and said, your attempts to keep the law are only making you more guilty because all the law did was prove sin to be all the more sinful. All the law did was show me that there is this law of sin in my members. And that while I delight in the law after the inward man, the sin in me keeps me from being able to perform the law. And that thing that I would do, I don't do. And the thing I wouldn't allow, that's what I do. So his point is that the law made sin all the more sinful. And he said, if it hadn't been for the law, I wouldn't have known that I was coveting. But the law came along and said, don't covet, and I realized I was guilty. So Israelites are guilty. Gentiles are guilty. Everybody's guilty. That's the whole point of him being able to build up to chapters 8, 9, 10. By the time he gets to 8, if God be for us, who can be against us? And then he gets into for whom he did foreknow. Those are the ones that he predestinated to be conformed to the image of his son. Those that he predestinated, those he called, those that he called, he justified. Those that he justified, he glorified. Now the answer to how can anybody be okay before God? We're all guilty. What about that? Chapter 8, he says, I'll answer it for you. It's God's electing grace. That's who gets saved. So people could say, well, the Gentiles who didn't know any better. Paul says, right, they didn't know any better and they're enemies of God. And you would say, oh, no fair. So the Israelites would stand up and say, well, we're under covenant with God, so we're okay, right? And Paul goes, you either, because you're trying to be justified by the law and you don't keep the law. So you're guilty too. So in other words, nobody can stand before God. That's the point of every tongue being stopped. Nobody gets to stand before God and be justified in their own behavior because either they didn't have the law and they were guilty, or they had the law. They had the full revelation of God of how to please him, how to do right before him. Here's what righteousness would look like, and nobody did it. So whether God reveals himself and says, here's what goodness looks like, Everybody's guilty under that. If he hides himself and says, I'm not going to tell you anything about myself, everybody's guilty under that. So no matter what the circumstances, leave men there, reveal or don't reveal, they end up enemies of God. So God has created two test cases. The Gentiles who are not under covenant, Israel who is under covenant, and they all fail. So all of humanity is guilty before God. So what's the answer? You need an intercessor. I don't care if you're a Jew. I don't care if you're a Gentile. You need somebody between you and God, and that's the platform from which Paul can launch into the gospel. So in the great, big, overarching historic frame, you've got God picking and choosing a group of people, Israel, who we'll call our test group, and he gives them every advantage and gives them prophecies. Even Messiah comes through their heritage. And they can't be justified. Even with God laying out all these rules, saying, here's what it would look like if you could do it right, they still don't do it. And then you've got the rest of the world who he reveals nothing to. The conclusion then is all mankind under all circumstances fail to live up to any kind of godliness. So then nobody gets saved? What's the answer? And Paul launches into grace. It's grace. That's the answer. The answer is grace. The answer is God's electing sovereign grace. That's the answer to your question. So, yes, the whole of the Old Testament is all about all the advantages Israel had. But it doesn't help them. In the end, they still need that Savior that all their prophets said, this is the only way you're going to get saved. Right? Yep. Let's just try to finish this section, okay? We just got as far as three times a year all the male shall appear before the Lord God, and you shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread. This is verse 18. Nor is the fat of my feast to remain overnight until morning. You shall bring the choice first fruits of your soil into the house of the Lord your God, and you shall not boil a kid in the milk of its mother. Behold, I am going to send an angel before you to guard you along the way and to bring you into the place which I have prepared for you. Isn't that a great promise? Wouldn't you like that one? Yeah. Oh, just do it my way. I'll send an angel out in front of you to fight your fights. Just do it my way. That's a big advantage. Be on your guard before him and obey his voice. Do not be rebellious toward him, for he will not pardon your transgression, since my name is in him. Isn't that interesting language? But if you will truly obey his voice and do all that I say, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. For my angel will go before you and bring you into the land of the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Canaanites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, and I will completely destroy them. Does that seem fair? I mean, big old marshmallow mushy God who loves everybody the same. That God who just wants everybody to come to him and give them all a fair chance. He picked a people group, chose them, and said, and I'll wipe out all these other people so that you can have their land, because you're my chosen people. It's completely fair. Why is it completely fair? Because he's God. Yeah, he's God. He can do whatever he wants. It's his creation. He does what he wants. Is it fair for him to say, I'll create heaven and I'll bring some people to it? The people I choose, the people I want, I'll bring into my everlasting happiness. And the rest, like a fire. Does that seem fair?
Sure.
Yeah. Sure. James with me. Sure, it's fair. Why is it fair? He's God. He can do whatever he wants. Yeah. And my point is, he's always been that way. These people who say, you know, that whole election thing, that was a Pauline thing that shows up in the New Covenant. No, it's all over the place. It's all through the Old Testament. You certainly see it here. Yes, sir.
The archaeologists today say that they've uncovered evidence that the Canaanites were really, really evil. And that's why God destroyed
And that's
them.
Why God did it. Yeah.
I don't think so, but.
Yeah, and later, are the Israelites going to be really, really good?
Well, I don't know.
Oh, by the way, Sunday, we were talking about principalities and powers, and I put up the word arche, which I said was first or primary. That is also the root word from archaeology, study of first things. So, hey, there you go. All right, what?
We think it's fair because we're pretty sure that we're saved, but if we're in that lake of fire, nobody's going to think it's fair.
Everybody who's in the lake of fire is going to be really frustrated and angry and upset about it, I am confident. But you know what?
It's fair.
It's fair. He's God. He can do it if he wants. And by the way, will they all be guilty that are in there?
Yeah.
So it is fair. They are his enemies. Right? Okay, let's try to wrap up here. I got to let you guys go. You shall not worship their gods. That's one of the reasons he's going to completely destroy them out of the land. You shall not worship their gods nor serve them. By the way, does Israel live up to that?
No.
No, of course not. Why did Solomon lose half the king? Well, half nothing. Out of the 12 tribes, he's going to end up losing everybody but Judah and Benjamin and the Levites that serve in the temple, all the other northern kingdoms he's going to lose. For what reason?
He's going chasing after other gods.
Yeah, other gods. And why does he chase after the other gods?
Because
he loved many strange women. He loves foreign women. They bring along their gods. He tries to gratify them, and God takes the kingdom from him. But here's a promise from God. Don't worship their gods. Don't serve them, nor do according to their deeds. But you shall utterly overthrow them and break their sacred pillars into pieces. But you shall serve the Lord your God, and he will bless your bread and your water, and I will remove sickness from your midst. Just do it my way. The advantages are huge. By the way, when Jesus was walking around in Israel, were there any sick people?
Yes.
Yeah, plenty of them. I guess God didn't live up to that part, huh? Or maybe Israel didn't live up to their part. Here's another promise, verse 26. There shall be no one miscarrying or barren in your land. I will fulfill the number of your days. You'll have long life, no miscarriages, no barren women. Just do it my way. Shouldn't this be adequate inducement to do it God's way?
Should be.
Why don't they?
Because they're human.
Because they're sinful humans. And even with every advantage and every promise, they don't do it. Do you think you'd do any better?
No.
No.
Oh, shucks.
Verse 27, I will send my terror ahead of you and throw into confusion all the people among whom you come, and I will make all your enemies turn their backs to you, and I will send hornets ahead of you that they may drive out the Hivites and the Canaanites and the Hittites before you, and I will not drive them out before you in one single year, that the land doesn't become desolate and the beasts of the field become too numerous for you. I will drive them out before you little by little until you become fruitful enough to take possession of the land. And I will fix your boundary from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines and from the wilderness to the River Euphrates. Where is that?
Iraq.
It's in Iraq.
Yeah.
Is that current Israel?
No.
No, so they've yet to possess everything they've been promised.
But this is over the door of the Knesset today.
Mm-hmm. This promise?
That's promise, right?
Yeah, that's all their land?
Yep.
Yeah. For I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you will drive them out before you. You shall make no covenant with them or with their gods. They shall not live in your land, lest they make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will certainly be a snare to you. Now you would think, let's talk about free will for a moment, and then I'll let you go home. Because you would think, if the whole free will thing is true, that all humans have this unencumbered ability at any moment to choose for themselves whether to do or not to do, if they are genuinely free in a libertarian way, and if all you have to do to get somebody to come to God is give them an adequate inducement so that their will turns in a positive way toward God, you can't find a more positive inducement than the promises we just read. Did anybody do it? And nobody did it. And Israel apostatized.
They just came out of Egypt, too.
Considering they'd just come out of Egypt, yeah. And they are going to continue to rebel and be stiff-necked. Soon, Moses is going to spend another 40 days up on the mountain. And while he's up there, after they've heard this, we're going to pick up next week at all that the Lord has said we will do. Unless Moses leaves us for 40 days, in which case we might make a calf and worship it. God has just said, Don't worship those gods. Don't make any foreign gods. Only serve the Lord your God. And they're not going to do it. And yet you would think they had plenty of inducement to do it God's way. So what do you learn?
We're sinful.
We're sinful. We're depraved. Ever since Adam, human beings simply are not going to do it God's way under any circumstances. And once again, that is why grace, 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 grace is such a necessity, and why the good news is such good news. Can you imagine what great news it would have been to any first century Israelite who was under the law and laboring under that law and trying as hard as they could to keep the law and justify themselves before God by that law? Can you imagine what good news it was the first time they heard, you don't need to keep that law? That law does not and cannot justify you. That law was given to make your sin all the more sinful. Now that you know you're a sinner, let me introduce you to the Savior. What terrifically good news that was. And yet, people still want to send Christians back to that law that never justified anybody, that never helped anybody, that even with the most wonderful promises and terrific inducement, still nobody could perform it. And yet somehow, people still think that in the church, you can, you're going to perform it to some level that's going to impress or please God. Get over that. Get over yourself and get back to worshiping the one in whom your redemption is full and complete, and all the promises of God in him are yea and amen. You got that? Okay. Any questions about that?
Stuff.
It is good stuff. And it's not even original stuff. It's all right here in this book. I'm just saying what the book says. I wish more preachers would just plagiarize the book with me. And we could just all plagiarize together and say the same thing.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.